In the first talk, I tried to say that we were created to be these receptacles of God's love. In the second talk, I tried to say that God's changing us from the inside out, transforming us from the inside out, setting up his kingdom within us. And the focus of that is that that's what the Messiah does. Just Jesus, person that we believe in, is the Messiah, the one who comes to take his residency in us to clean us up. The third talk, follow me, this comes from many different places in the Gospels, but especially, as I was saying, right after this dialogue with Peter. And Jesus says to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You think like men think. You see the world the way men see the world. You don't see it the way God sees it. Jesus then, it says, just speaks to his disciples quite generally. And he says, really, in effect, this. It's not just that this is what the Messiah has to go through, but this is what you have to go through. If anyone wants to follow after me, the Christ, the person you're proclaiming is the Christ, here's what you have to do. You have to deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. Okay? And that was, in a way, we've already been talking about this theme, the ways in which we follow God, in practical ways through trials and afflictions that we face. We to keep in mind that if we're following Christ, where did Christ go? When he picked up his cross, he went to Golgotha. He was crucified. And so if we're following Christ, we're following him to Golgotha. If we want to live with him, we have to die with him. This is such a common theme in Epistles of St. Paul. And follow me is the characteristic way in which Jesus called his disciples. Peter and Andrew, fishing by the sea. Follow me. James and John, fishing by the sea. Follow me. Matthew or Levi, he called in some of the Gospels, in his tax office. Follow me. This is the core activity, in the sense of contemplation and action. The core activity is simply following Christ, having that kind of a ear to him. That my sheep hear my voice, and they follow me, Jesus says in the 10th chapter of the Gospel of John. There's this hearing and following. I recognize that voice. There's a lot of voices in our culture. They want us to go, it's just like Jesus said, with the kingdom. Oh, come over here, this is the kingdom. We'll tell you how to live your life. Oh, no, come over there, this is the kingdom over there. We'll tell you how to live your life. And this plethora of voices, there's a voice that's the Good Shepherd. We hear it and we follow it. So this theme of following me is tied in with this notion of obedience that we saw in this prophecy from Isaiah of Christ himself. It was the Messiah would be given a tongue and an ear. And the ear was deeply connected to obedience, even obedience, as we're told in Philippians, to the point of death. Death on a cross. Okay? And this is exactly the obedience that Christ calls us to. Now, how I want to focus our attention then on this is that while God is changing us from the inside out, our contribution to God's work, maybe to speak a little bit more like an Orthodox, our cooperation with God's work is a little bit more from the outside in. It would be nice if we could all just be still and quiet and contemplative and experience a beautiful communion with God. But in fact, we have to do things. For example, we have to pray with our body. It's extremely important that we pray with our body. The psalmist talks about using our lips to pray. Lift up hands, Paul, lift up holy hands to pray. Jesus says when you stand to pray, Paul says when you stand to pray. We know these things in Orthodoxy. These are postures of prayer. We cross ourselves. We do prostrations. We use our body in prayer. If we, as it were working from the inside out, it might be that our focus would be on doing nothing. I just want to focus on the inside. I don't want to do anything. But in fact, we're always called to be doing things, to venerate in an icon. We're doing things with our body, a whole different in prayer. And so prayer is a very active thing. Even Jesus says, get up and go in your closet and shut the door. Your location matters. Go somewhere. The fathers will eventually interpret going into your closet and shutting the door as entering your heart. But they're very clear that we only come to learn how to enter our heart by first having entered the closet. And so St. John of the Ladder, St. John Sinai, even his stuff on silence toward the end, maybe 26, 27, somewhere in there, says that early in our practice, we can be all alone, early in our practice of stillness, we can be all alone, totally freed from external stimuli, and be totally a wreck inside. Okay? But late in our progress in learning about the life of stillness, we can be in utter chaos in a crowd, right? And still have inner stillness. We have to engage ourselves little by little in ways that teach us how to have the inner stillness, and one of it is simply going into a literal quiet space, maybe not a closet, but your own room, and shut the door. Turn off the radio, turn off the TV, close the blinds. I will just tell you personally, I'm very distracted by birds that fly by the window. They just bother me. I mean, they distract me from my prayer. I look out the window, and then I see a car, and then I see something else, and all of a sudden, I'm not looking at the icon. So just shut the shades. It works. We have to be very practical in these outward ways if we want to learn how to cultivate the inner side. So in thinking of this way in which the fathers play with this entering the closet, we have to literally enter a quiet space in order to learn how to enter the heart as a quiet space. Okay, so we do external things. We guard our senses. We pay attention to what we look at, what we listen to, what we taste, what we touch. We're cautious about what we do with our bodily senses because we want to cut ourselves off from unnecessary stimuli so we can become more aware of what's going on inside. And as God transforms us more on the inside, we'll be less affected by what we see or what we hear or what we do, smell or whatever it might be. Okay? I mentioned last time, fasting. Same thing. It's a very active thing. It's a very bodily thing. It's a very external thing. And so, we can think of contemplation as something that God is doing in us. So many of the ascetic fathers see the cleaning up of our inner life is something that God has to do. It is the Lord who cleans up the mess that's in my life. My contribution, my cooperation with that isn't so much by me cleaning up a little bit of it as it is by me getting my external part, myself, my body, arranged in such a way where that can be the focus, where the inner life can be the focus. Okay? So, there's many, many different ways to look at this, to think about this, but I want to approach it by reflecting on the text from Matthew chapter 6. We hear it at the very beginning of Great Lent, the weekend of Forgiveness Sunday, when really at the sort of the heart of the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus says, don't practice your righteousness before men the way the hypocrites do. And then he gives three examples. Giving alms or acts of mercy, I'll just call it acts of mercy, acts of kindness, acts of mercy. Praying and fasting, those three things. Okay? Now, about those three things, it's very clear that these are the way that Jesus is thinking about them are things that we do with our body. We give alms. We help somebody out in some concrete, tangible way. obviously this resonates very strongly with the Sunday of Last Judgment. Who is it? Who are the sheep that end up on the right side? They're the ones that fed me when I was hungry, gave me drink when I was thirsty, visited me when I was in prison. These are all acts of kindness. These are acts of mercy. So that criterion that's used there for the Last Judgment is right out of acts of mercy. These are all very tangible, very explicit things. Neither the sheep nor the goats notice that they were meeting Christ, face to face with Christ, when they were visiting people in prison or visiting somebody who was sick and shut in, feeding somebody who was hungry. But in fact, they were being drawn into the presence of Christ or removing themselves from the presence of Christ. When did we see you and not feed? When did we see you hungry and not feed you? When did we see you thirsty? All of those times in which I heard this little voice and I turned away, I drew back. All of those times, that's when. And so there's this very tangible outward movement in our lives with acts of mercy. So very practically speaking, how is it that we can contribute, or again, better to say, cooperate with the work of God in our lives of cleaning us from the inside out? We can put ourselves in situations where we're doing acts of mercy, acts of kindness. It might be giving somebody a little bit of money, but it might be visiting somebody, it might be calling somebody who didn't show up at church, it might be visiting somebody in the nursing home, it might, whatever it might be. It doesn't have to be somebody you don't know. It doesn't have to be starting a prison ministry. It can be somebody in your own family. You can choose to do acts of God. You can choose to do the dishes, even though it's not your responsibility in the home. You can choose to clean up the yard. You can choose to do anything you want. That's an act of kindness for someone else. In the simplest ways, don't think that I have to come up with some really grand scheme for how I'm going to be so kind. Think of the simplest things you could do during the day. A kind word, a phone call, picking up some things around the house, whatever it might be, that are simply acts of kindness to other people. I think that's what Jesus has in mind here. Now, he says that in all three of these cases, the focus is doing these things secretly, and I'm going to talk about that at the end, okay? The aspect of don't do it publicly, do it secretly. The second thing is prayer. And so I was talking with some of you at the break about prayer. And in my introductory comments to this section, I talked about prayer as being part of the use of our body. Almost everybody I know struggles with having a regular prayer life. And we're sort of, I don't know what, kind of embarrassed to admit it or whatever. Some of the times I think the problem is that we have too grand of an ideal for what I need to do to pray. Some of the times we think of prayer as being too inner and not involving our body enough. I simply want to say about prayer that it's best if we could just do something very little every day. You wouldn't leave the house without changing from your pajamas into your clothes, unless the house was burning down or something like that. Right? Some people wouldn't leave the house without drinking their coffee. Wouldn't leave the house without brushing your teeth, whatever it might be, you know? There's just certain things you wouldn't do. So there should be some aspect of your life in prayer, morning, evening, whatever it is, whatever the situation might be, it'd be different for different people. Some people work nights, some people have changing schedules, students are this schedule this semester, that schedule next semester, whatever it might be. You have to sort of figure these things out. But we need to have something in our life that is bringing our life before God with our body and saying, Lord, here I am, my whole being. Okay? I think the simplest thing to do is to get up in the morning and do a prostration before the icon. It's very simple. And maybe you can do the Trisagion. Maybe you'll just do the Lord's Prayer. Maybe you can do more. But the most important thing is that it's a stake in the ground. I'm going to do it. And I'm going to do it with my whole body. A lot of people tell me, and I've done plenty of this in the past, but I don't drive anywhere now, but a lot of people tell me their best time for prayer is when they are driving to work. Or driving to the, not the, what do you call these exercise places? The gym. Or, no, there's some name for it. Now. What's the name? I can't remember now. But.
YMCA?
No, I don't know, gym. I guess it's
just,
fitness. Yeah, it's like a fitness place. Yeah, fitness plan, something like that. Yeah. I think it's good to pray while you're in the car. I think that's a good thing. Pray
while the only difficulty is can't really have a lit candle.
Yes, there's lots of difficulties. It's hard to do frustrations while you're driving.
You turn and you stop, and the hot wax is flashing a little
bit. Oh, you speak from experience, I have to say.
No, not speaking from experience. I know physics that well.
So I'm in favor of praying in the car, but I don't think that. I think at some point we have to enter the closet. And pray. And it doesn't have to be for 3 hours or whatever it is. It has to be what you can actually do and do regularly and just do it. You enter the closet and pray, even if it's only one frustration or just the Lord's Prayer, just the Trisagion. Whatever, you know, work this out with your own confessor, spiritual father, and don't change it very quickly. One of Satan's tricks is to let you have a great experience for a day, a week, a month. You'll really feel good, and you'll double your prayer rule, and you'll triple your prayer rule, and then you'll collapse and do nothing for the next 3 months because you just got in way over your head. And so it's most important that we do something that's very simple, very regular, and is just, I'm not doing anything else. I'm not driving the car. I'm not making lunch. I'm just praying. For some time of the day. Sure, if you're driving the car, pray. If you're making lunch, pray. Pray at all times. But at some point in our lives, Lord willing, every day, we should just pray. And nothing else. Anything else is a distraction. Okay? And that prayer should include some aspect of praying with our body, with our lips, with raised hands, crossing ourselves, prostrations, whatever it might be. Okay? The total offering of ourselves. And then fasting. I just want to say this one aspect about fasting. So again, fasting is a way in which we cooperate with God's work in our lives. And when we focus on fasting, we're focusing on, is it a meat day? Is it a wine and oil day? Is it a fish day? What do I get to eat today and what can't I? We focus on types of food. Okay? That should come. You just find your calendar and figure out what you get. But if you look at the church fathers, look at St. John Cassian, a couple different things on this. St. Gregory Palamos has several beautiful sermons on fasting. The chapter, the step in St. John Climacus on fasting. None of them say anything at all about whether it's a meat day or a fish day or a wine and oil day. They don't mention one single word about it. It's just not their focus. Okay? What do they care about? It almost always comes down to three things. These three come from St. John Cassian, but they're very common in all the fathers on fasting. Don't eat to satiation. Don't eat until you're full. Always leave some hunger. Okay? So if it's a bean day today. I'm just going to eat beans, and I'm going to eat beans until I'm stuffed. You did not keep the spirit of the fast from the fathers. You were not fasting in the sense that they think of it. Okay? Sure, you didn't eat meat. You didn't eat wine, whatever. But you ate to the point of being stuffed or full or even satisfied. Their point is leave some hunger. Leave a little bit of hunger. Okay? Don't eat anytime you want. They say eat at appointed times only. But I'll just say don't eat anytime you want. Okay? And the third is don't eat too fancy. Don't eat, caviar and Bordeaux every day or something like that, you know. Don't eat rich foods. Don't eat brie cheese on every chance you get on a dairy day or whatever. Be cautious about the types of food you eat in the sense of what they're doing to your resolve, They really think of it in terms of resolve. If you go around having wine and cheese on every available day, it's going to loosen your resolve. Okay? It's those three things. They occur over and over and over in the Fathers. I simply want to focus on this. I think this is what's behind, especially the first two. Fasting is intended to teach us that we are to yearn for the food that doesn't perish. I think that is the sum total point of fasting. We yearn for the food that doesn't perish. If we fill ourselves up with perishable food, we lose that yearning for a little while because I'm going to get hungry again. And then I'm going to fill it with whatever's in the refrigerator, whatever's in the counter. I'm going to go grab some nuts. I'm not going to let that hunger stay in me. I'm going to go make a peanut butter sandwich. I'm going to go do whatever. I'm going to go look at the calendar and find out what I'm permitted to eat today. And then I'm going to go fill myself back up because I don't want that gnawing hunger to stay there. And the Fathers say, no, let it stay there. And let yourself experience that desire for perishable food as really a desire for the food that doesn't perish. Just like Jesus with the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman at the well. The water that quenches our thirst forever. Not the water that we drink from this well and you're going to thirst again. We want the water that quenches our thirst forever. And so I think that fasting, in a sense, really comes down to this. Cultivating a continual hunger. We don't have to starve ourselves, you know. But cultivating this kind of yearning, awareness, and then coming to experience that yearning as, Lord, I want to be filled with you. That's why in preparation for the Eucharist, we have a stricter fast. Right? We don't eat anything. And it doesn't do any good to eat a 7-course meal at 11:45 at night. Well, I'm done with it before midnight because at 9 in the morning or whenever liturgy is, I'm not hungry. No, the point is that when we approach the divine liturgy, when we approach the holy gifts, I'm yearning. I want food. I want to be filled. I want to be filled by Christ. Okay? And so, fasting is about cultivating this hunger for the imperishable food. So, acts of mercy, prayer with our body, and fasting in such a way that we're cultivating this hunger for God are very tangible, outward, external things that we do that are our ways of cooperating with what God's doing inside of us. Okay? Now, the way that that becomes so vividly clear is that he takes all three of these and says, your temptation is to do these external, outward, visible, physical actions in such a way that they draw attention to you. That's why we know they're physical, out external. That's why we know they're not just works of the heart. We know that they're out there. They can be seen. I can donate money and have my name put on the building. Okay? I can pray in such a way that I'm standing on the street corner and everybody can hear me. I can fast and say, oh, I'm so tired of beans. If I see another bean, I'm just going to vomit, you know. And Jesus says, this kind of external activity that you're engaged in is revealing in you this desire to be seen by other people. That's exactly what's happening. Dross is coming up from the inside. I want somebody to acknowledge me. I want somebody to thank me. I'm the only one who ever brings food for the coffee hour. I'm the only one who ever stays and cleans up after everybody else goes home. Nobody acknowledges me. I want to be acknowledged by men. I want to be seen. God knows, our Lord knows we have that desire to be seen by men. And he says, I want you to engage in these practices that are absolutely exterior practices. They are absolutely out there to be seen and be visible, and I want you to do them in such a way that nobody knows. I want you to do them in secret, as much as you are able. Don't expose any of your deeds to what anybody can see. And what's going to happen to us if we do that? Well, first thing's gonna happen, just we have no motivation whatsoever. I have no motivation to do any of these things unless I can be seen by other people. I just don't. I don't want to do a good deed unless somebody can thank me for it and pat me on the back. You know, I don't want to go pray unless I can you know, say, oh, that was such a beautiful prayer, whatever, you know. So I'll experience this loss of motivation. But that loss of motivation will be a revelation of how much I'm depending on the praises of men. And so it's that dross coming to the surface. Another thing that we revealed to us is how grumpy and complaining we get. Because we'll say things like, I'm the only one who ever does this. No one ever thanks me for that. Okay? So I still do it. But I do it in such a way that I drag several people down to hell with me. You know? In a gossipy way, in a complaining way, in a whatever. Okay? And so what's being revealed in me is this dross coming up to the surface. Christ puts us in this situation. Again, these are the voluntary actions. These are the voluntary ways that we place ourselves in situations externally so that God can reveal what's going on inside of us. Now, I want to end with this. St. John Chrysostom comments on this passage and says, why is it that our Lord wants us to do these things in secret? And what is the reward that the Father is going to give us? Remember, every single time the text says, if you do these things openly, then you got your reward before men already. But if you do these things in secret, your Father will reward you. And in some translations, or some Greek texts, reward you openly. Okay? I won't worry too much about the openly part now, but the Father will reward you. Okay? What's the reward? What's the reward we get by doing these things in secret? St. John puts it very, very simply, very, very beautifully. We have this yearning to be seen, to be appreciated, to be acknowledged. And so we do all of these things in our lives so that other people can see us and acknowledge us. And St. John says, you know, that desire to be seen, to be wanted, to be appreciated, to be acknowledged, that's really a pretty good desire. But it only has its fulfillment in the Father. You want to be seen by the Father. You want to be appreciated by the Father. You want to be acknowledged by the Father. You want to be thanked by the Father. And as long as you put yourself in the context of the praises of men, you will never hear the Father's words, well done, good and faithful servant. You will only hear the noise that comes from the people you're showing off in front of. But if you let yourself do these things in secret, in quiet, without drawing attention to yourself, you'll hear the Father's words to you, the Father's acknowledgement of you. You'll experience yourself as His child, His embrace, His comfort. And so this desire that we have to be seen is a desire that is a good desire, but we misdirect it. We want to be seen by everyone but God. I'll end with this story. My first year at Dormition Monastery, I was serving service. I don't remember which service it was, but I was just ordained a priest right before coming to the Dormition Monastery. And I said to Father Roman, and I must have been making my normal mistakes, something was distracting me. And I said to Father Roman, how is it that you stop thinking about people looking at you when you're serving in the altar? And he got a big smile on his face, and he said, oh, Father, nobody's looking at you. And I'm thinking, what do you mean? There's these people out there, and we were behind that Constasis. There's these people out there. They're looking at me. I'm making mistakes. They're thinking I'm a fool, whatever it is. You know? So there was this pause. There was this time for me to think. And I'm thinking, like, what's he talking about? Oh, Father, nobody's looking at you. I don't think that they're that holy or whatever. And then he said, only God's eyes are on you, and he sees you from within your heart. Isn't that so beautiful? From Father Roman's perspective, the vision, the image, the experience of God's eyes on us, on him, is so powerful that you don't even notice the eyes of anybody else. It's not that nobody's looking at you. They are looking at you, but you don't even notice them. In the second coming, Jesus says that the moon and the sun will be darkened. St. John Chrysostom says, Jesus doesn't mean that they're going to be extinguished. Their fire is going to go out. He means that the brightness of the Son of God returning is going to be so bright that you'll no longer be able to see the sun and the moon. It's the brightness of the Son of God that makes the sun invisible, the S-U-N, invisible. It's not that the sun burns out. And so it is that the eyes of God on us become so powerful that the eyes of everyone else on us is invisible. This happens to us as we carry out our ascetic effort in these ways and in other ways as invisibly as we can. As invisibly as we can. And that's how it is that we assist in letting God cleanse our inner life to the point where we can see only his eyes on us.